Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Coming up, I meet a mudlark.
Sometimes you do find big chunks of pottery. There's always something interesting.
You'll find out about the community project unearthing Scotland's first railway.
And the King honours Time Team's creator.
It's all on the Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. And we are on YouTube, so you can see us as well as listen to us. We're back as well after our episodes at Sutton Hoo. Have you recovered yet, Helen?
Well, it was quite exhausting. I actually slept for 10 hours the night after we finished, but it was so rewarding too. I mean, particularly finding out so much about the bucket. I've still got to digest all of that information. I haven't managed to combine the whole lot in my head together, but we found out so much.
Yeah, and keep subscribed to Time Team's YouTube channel because we are going to be bringing you the programmes that we made whilst we were there. That isn't going to be for a little while though, so if you're itching for more from Sutton Hoo, why not check out the podcast that we made whilst we were there? I think we recorded about 4 episodes from on site, so you actually got to go behind the scenes and get up close and personal with the archaeology and find out exactly what was going on site.
And if you've been finding it a bit hot recently, you could go and listen to our episode we recorded in the tipping down downpour to feel a bit cooler.
Yes, definitely.
Now, archaeology can be done anywhere. It could be on a Hoo in Suffolk, or it could be at the heart of Europe's biggest city. And Martin's been invited to take a walk along the banks of the Thames in London, where he's finding out about an activity that dates back hundreds of years, which can tell us so much about the city's history.
Millions of people live here in London, and they've lived here for thousands of years. And all of the stuff that they've generated over that time, a lot of it ends up here on the foreshore of the River Thames. And there's a whole community of people called mudlarks who like to walk up and down here and see what treasure they can find. Well, now there's a new exhibition dedicated to some of the amazing finds that have been made right here. And I've come to find out more about it.
My name is Tom Coughlin and I'm mudlark. We're on a tidal river. So there's a big chunk of, you know, bit between low tide and high tide, which you can get down to and where stuff has just been discarded or lost and preserved by anaerobic clay. And so that provides a time capsule. And it's a city that's existed for 2,000 years. You know, I think there was a sort of 400-year period in the middle, 600 to 900, where the city was actually abandoned and then reoccupied. And I think the story of London is a deeply interesting one.
And Tom and I have been for a walk along the foreshore to find out how he does it.
As you're walking along as a mudlark, your kind of eyes are down. You're being wary of great big ships coming past that make a huge bow wash and sort of wash over your boots. You're hoping to see, to really home in on tiny little areas and begin to pick out what might be shards of, to me, fascinating Roman pottery or little bits of Delftware from the 16th century, 17th century.
So for all the miles that you're walking along here, how often are you coming across stuff of interest and how often is it just sort of shards of glass or a stone or something like that?
I would say if you're spending a couple of hours down here, and I wouldn't expect anyone to spend much more than that, I end up picking up 20, 30 bits of something I find really interesting. I mean, I would usually end up with a big handful of bits. We're going to have to get out of this bow wash, which this is actually a really important point to make, is that these boats coming up and down the Thames are washing away mud banks that have built up over hundreds of years. And so within those mud banks, there are layers that equate to a time period. And the arrival of particularly these catamarans since, I think, the 1990s has really accelerated erosion, and that means that more stuff is washing out.
And it was whilst mudlarking, right here actually, that Tom made a remarkable discovery.
I was just up here, and as I walked, something just vibrated at the very edge of my peripheral vision, and I walked on a couple of steps and then thought, hang on, that was interesting. I went back, and there was this bit of leather, and it was just lightly vibrating like that. I thought that looks quite, you know, strange. And I could look closely, and I could see that there was something kind of man-made sort of etched onto it. When I got home, ran this object under the tap, and as the mud started to come away, I was looking at it, and I could see what looked like a kind of knight in medieval armour. And I was washing it, and I was thinking, oh my God, this is absolutely amazing. And I washed more. There were two knights on kind of two sides of this leather, and then there were little roses around it. And I realised these are Tudor roses. This has to be something really special.
And it really was. More on that in a moment. But first, Tom was keen to show me what things are usually like.
So this is some of the stuff that I've just found really within a sort of 100 metres of where we are now, or a couple of 100 metres. And they're just very typical.
Is this like a pipe here?
So this is, that would be a pipe. This, I think that one would be about 1750, probably 1750. These are bits of Tudor pottery, probably 400 years old or something. It's a very distinct green glaze that that you get on medieval and late, immediately post-medieval ware, and painted by some, you know, long dead hand many hundreds of years ago. It's exciting stuff for people like me. I mean, I don't know if it's exciting for anyone else.
Well, I can tell how much you love it, and thank you so much for bringing me here and showing me this amazing stuff that you found and telling me about the amazing find, which I am going to go and see now. So I'm going to leave you, and I'm going to go and see what you found just down there for myself in person. So
it's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you.
Cheers.
The remarkable thing about mudlarking is that it's a totally different environment. You get things in the river that you don't get elsewhere, and it's not just the organics. Particularly by the bridges, there are things that were thrown in hoping that nobody would ever find them. Things like murder weapons or incriminating things or embarrassing things. All human life is there. But we should say, though, that not anyone is allowed to go mudlarking. You can't just turn up on the foreshore and see what you can find. It's absolutely vital that you do it responsibly, and that means applying for and getting a permit from the Port of London Authority.
Well, our mudlarking story doesn't end there, because later on in the podcast you'll find out a little bit more about what happened when I went to an exhibition that's just opened at London Museum, which is dedicated to mudlarking and how it benefits archaeology, how it benefits our historical understanding of the capital. And that exhibition features the object that Tom discovered, which I can tell you now was a prayer book cover. So you'll find out more about that later in the podcast.
We like a good community archaeology and heritage project here on Time Team. And in Kirkenzie, not far from Edinburgh, trowels are going into the ground again in a few months' time to discover more about the UK's longest wooden railway, which dates back to the 1700s.
The 1722 Wagonway Heritage Group are running the project, and Anthony Dawson is one of the archaeologists who's involved in the work. Great to see you, Anthony.
Likewise, Martin, and Helen as well.
Yeah, lovely to see you. Explain then, what is a wagonway?
A wagonway is a precursor to a railway. Effectively, it works like a railway. You have a set of rails in the ground, usually made of wood, with a wagon running on top of it, with wheels with flanges on, often pulled by a horse.
So is it used in the same way as a railway, that it's kind of bulk transport? It's easier than a road?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. You can move a heavier load far easier because there's less rolling resistance between the vehicle and the road surface. And in the case of the Trenent Kirkenzie wagonway, it runs across a marsh.
How long is this wagonway? How much investment in the area are we talking about?
It runs for about 4 kilometres from Trenent down to Kirkenzie. Part of the experimental work we did last year in building a full-size replica section of track showed that it doesn't need much of an investment in terms of manpower.
So how long do you think it might have taken to build?
We think you could build a kilometre of track in about a month.
Right,
and that's using a team of about 12 to 24 people.
So tell me a little bit about the archaeology then that you've done so far, because I mentioned you're going to have a second stab at it in September. What's already been done?
In 2019, we put a sondage over the route of the wagon way where it crosses the Preston Pans battlefield. The evidence was inconclusive. And then COVID happened, but we went back to have another look in 2021. 2021 was completely mind-blowing, because what we found on a dryland site was mineralised rails and sleepers, but we also found at the bottom of the trench wet wood still in situ.
Oh, wow. So that's amazing. So what has the archaeology you've done so far then told you about what life would have been like, how that wagon way was used?
We know it was used to transport coal from the coal pits at Trenent down to Cockenzie to be burned to make salt in the various salt pans, and that the coal was exported as sea coal along the Scottish coast and down the Forth. So it probably got as far as Edinburgh.
I don't know about you, Martin, but it's something that I never really think about, the great need for salt before fridges and so on, the great need for salt to feed the growing towns, to keep the meat from going off. It's just something that we tend to forget about a bit.
I suppose we do, don't we? Because of our reliance on fridges and that sort of thing. You're right, you would have needed so much more salt to preserve things. You're going back then in September, Anthony. What are you hoping that you might discover in the next round of archaeological work that you're going to be doing on site?
We want to have another look at what we found in 2021, just to confirm our results. So working from the known to the unknown, but also to assess the level of preservation on the route of the wagon way as it crossed the Preston Pans battlefield. So we know in our 2021 trenches we had the wet wood, we had the mineralised wood. Is the state of that preservation as good on other sections?
Remind us what the Battle of Preston Pans was.
1745, in September 1745, between the forces of the Jacobites, Bonnie Prince Charlie, and the government troops, it was a disaster for the British, but it means that the Trenent-Cockenzie wagonway was the first railway to be fought over in the battle, and it turned into a complete massacre. And we know that Prince Charlie had to come down the wagonway, because it was the only route across this marsh, waving his hat, telling his men to actually stop the massacre.
Anthony, it's so interesting to learn about this wagonway and the work that the Heritage Group is doing to try and preserve it and find out more about it. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it.
My absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anthony. And if you want to find out more, you can head to 1722wagonway.co.uk. And wagon has got two G's, which is a kind of... I hadn't realised until I read that there are two different ways of spelling wagon and that presumably they mean something, but I'm digressing into words again. I do find them so fascinating.
Right, time to bring you up to date with a few archaeological discoveries now. And Danny Wootton's here for Time Team News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Martin. Well, firstly, we're off to central Denmark, where the surprise discovery of a cemetery possibly belonging to a noble family of the late 10th century AD has been announced. The site contains 30 graves, and items such as pearls, coins, ceramics, and a box of which only three are known, and a pair of scissors have all been excavated. In the 1980s, the farm of a noble family was discovered very close to the site, and so it's thought that the burial site might once have belonged to an earl or steward of King Harald Bluetooth Gormson. Some of the items from the excavation will go on display at Mosgard Museum this summer. To Britain now, where thousands of pieces of painted plaster from a Roman building have been discovered in London. Now, you may recall the Roman mausoleum story from the August 2023 Time Team News. Well, this is from the same Museum of London Archaeology excavations in Southwark. The plaster was discovered in a large pit, which it had been put into originally when the building was demolished, and it contains enough plaster probably for about 20 internal walls. And there are amazing colours, including yellow, green, black, and a speckled pink colour designed to imitate Egyptian porphyry, which is a kind of crystal speckled volcanic stone. And there are images of musical instruments, birds, fruit, and even a simple daisy. And intriguingly, there's even an etching of the ancient Greek alphabet, which is the only known example in Roman Britain. Senior building materials specialist Hanley has said that reconstructing the thousands of pieces of plaster was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and that it was a bit like assembling the world's most difficult jigsaw puzzle. And finally, we go from paintings of Roman fruit and flowers to Italy for real fruit and flowers in a Pompeian garden known as the Garden of Hercules. The garden has been meticulously restored using information from botanist Wilhelmina Jaszemski, who identified spores, pollen, and plant remains in the 1950s. Now the garden has been planted with 1,200 violets, 1,000 ruscus plants, 800 roses and cherries, quince trees and vines. In past excavations, an extensive irrigation system had been discovered that consisted of water channels that carried water to flower beds, and also large pots were set into the ground where water would collect for extra watering. They also discovered many small glass unguent bottles that suggests that perfume was being made in the garden. Around 2,000 years after its destruction, isn't it wonderful that this ancient garden has been brought back to life? Well, that's all from me for now. I look forward to seeing you on the next Time Team News.
Thank you, Danny.
Now, a few moments ago, you saw me sloshing about on the banks of the River Thames in London, where I met Tom.
He's a mudlark, a volunteer with a permit from the Port of London Authority, which allows him to walk up and down the foreshore looking for objects of archaeological significance. Now, mudlarking's been around in London for generations, and originally it was people scavenging for things to sell, things like coal, old bits of rope, if they were lucky, a few coins. But now it's used as a way of preserving London's history before it's washed away. And London Museum in Docklands is displaying the prayer book cover, which Tom found as part of a whole new exhibition, and lucky old Martin has been for a nosy round.
This is the museum where they've just opened a brand new exhibition looking at mudlarking and putting a lot of the finds that mudlarkers have made on display.
Yep, and I'm going to be meeting the curator of the exhibition, Kate Sumnell, who's going to show me round.
Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, and welcome to Secrets of the Thames.
Thank you very much. Shall we have a look around?
Yeah, let's show you.
I think what they've done here is really cool. They've recreated the foreshore so you can experience what it might be like to go mudlarking.
It's dressed with the sorts of pebbles and stones that you find down there, as well as modern bricks, things like that. But also we've put in a few treats for visitors to see if they can spot and find. So there are sometimes replicas of objects that are in cases or things that are related to the things in the cases. We've not made it easy. They're going to have to really look carefully.
There are more than 350 mudlarked artefacts on display here, ranging from prehistory to the 20th century. And one of them is the book cover, which Tom discovered.
Tom's book is a really, really rare survival. It is the leather bookbinding from a book of prayers, and it dates to around about the middle of the 16th century. It is so rare because so few of these survive. Often only the posh books, the important books that make it into collections and libraries, those are the ones that survive. And in fact, often they've been recovered as fashions change. These early sorts of books, they were just such everyday items that, you know, I don't think people thought to collect them. They give an insight into how many Londoners could actually read, and these books would not only be used to say prayers, but they were the way that many families taught their children to read as well.
It was a real privilege to see Tom's book in person, but my visit wasn't over. Kate had one more surprise up her sleeve.
And I can't wait to show you the final moment of the exhibition that explains just why the Thames is tidal.
Wow, okay, you're spelling it out here. The moon is definitely a good reason why the Thames is tidal. This is incredible. And you know what? It's so peaceful in here as well.
It is. We were really trying to create the atmosphere that speaks to what so many mudlarks tell us about, just how peaceful they find being down by the river and immersed in the practice of mudlarking. They say it's so good for their mental health, their well-being, and so we wanted this moment of reflection.
That is such a lovely ending to the exhibition, isn't it? And as Kate says, it sums up the calmness and the kind of slightly hypnotic or mesmeric nature of the foreshore with its rhythm of waves and tides. And I bet it's also a really good way of persuading somebody to visit who thinks that they're not interested in the past. Hey, come along and see this really cool giant image of the moon. It's so unexpected, isn't it?
It is beautiful as well, and you are so instantly calmed the second that you walk into that room. A really interesting exhibition, and if you want to experience it yourself, it runs at London Museum Docklands, which is just on the riverside, kind of Wapping Way in London. It runs until March next year, so you've got plenty of time to go and experience it for yourself.
We received some very exciting news the other day here at Time Team, which we wanted to share with you.
Yes, Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, has been awarded an MBE in the King's Birthday Honours for services to archaeology and heritage.
And Tim is here with us now. Congratulations, Tim. How did you find out that you've been awarded an MBE?
Well, about a month ago, I was contacted with an amazing letter from the Cabinet Office, and I thought, this is another parking fine I've got here, or some overdue rates bill. It was a beautifully worded letter, absolutely charming, and saying, delighted to say that we'd like you to accept this. And so that was how I found out. I then had to shut up, which I did. I didn't talk to anybody about anything for about a month. And I knew the date it was released in the Gazette, the 13th, I think it was. I, you know, rang my nearest and dearest and went, woohoo! And wow, amazing. So there's a certain amount of ironic comments obviously being made. We'll have to call you something different, Timothy, sort of thing. And that sort of thing. But yes, it was absolutely charming. Thank you.
Tim B.E.
Yes. We could work on that, couldn't
we'll
we?
We'll have to work on
that. So how did that moment feel then when you it sort of suddenly dawned on you?
I don't know. I thought about Mick, you know, and the people who've, you know, began landscape archaeology all those years ago. When I think of that original group who took a big risk, you know, as archaeologists, and Tony, it wasn't an obvious fit for Tony really to come on board. Obviously, Mick there and Phil and Carenza and dear John and Stuart and later Helen joining the group. It was that support those people gave to the idea and the risk they took that enabled Time Team to happen. And everything else we've done since then is kind of built on those foundations.
You're kind of a representative. You know, when Rosemary Cramp, the famous Anglo-Saxon archaeologist at Durham, Professor Rosemary Cramp got a damehood, we all said, my goodness, that means archaeology, archaeologists are important enough to get a damehood. We all got reflected glory. And I think people, you know, Victor and Mick and Robin and so on, they didn't manage to get one, but you've got one, and it's kind of for all of us. We're all basking in the glory that taking archaeology and heritage and bringing them to the people is important enough to be recognised and honoured.
And I'm so pleased about that. One of my strongest memories of Mick, when we first went out to a place called Broadwood Widger, which was near Roadford Reservoir, they found Anglo-Saxon pottery. And they thought, my goodness, what's going on? There's thousands of years of history here. So Mick and I went out there and did some filming with this. And I remember him taking me round a little local village, and we looked in the back garden of the allotments, and there were pieces of medieval pottery. And Mick, being Mick, was able to bring it alive. And so people have got this stuff. And for most English people, British people, we're very lucky to have outside the remnants of the past, which go right back to, at Dunster, we were finding Neolithic flint. We can bring a whole new community. I'll tell you this, the other day I did a talk at Heligan. I began with, I think, the way Mick used to begin. You looked across the landscape and I said to the assembled crowd, what do you think is the oldest thing in the landscape? And a little kid in the front stuck his hand up and he said, you. And I said to him,
well, now it's you, MBE. So that's, and he'd do well to remember that.
Just one more question then, Tim. When do you get to go to Buckingham Palace and who can you take with you?
You can take your partner and your daughter. That's going to involve a new hat, I think, somewhere along the line.
For you or for the other two?
For the other two, I think. I'll definitely, you know, get some photographs done. And I might even try and wear a stripy T-shirt underneath my posh shirt.
That all sounds absolutely brilliant. I'll look forward to the pictures. I hope you can build in a little memento, take Mick with you in some shape or form. And it does sound very exciting.
A little doll in for my lapel would be nice,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be nice. Yes, a tiny mini Mick.
A tiny mini Mick making his way through the palace.
OK, it's questions time now on the Time Team podcast. These have been suggested by our Patreon supporters. And if you want to ask a question on a future edition of the podcast, make sure you get yourself onto Patreon. I'll give you all the details in just a moment. Before I get to the questions, we had this great comment and photo come in to us on Patreon. It comes from Joe Woods, who just says this, right? No question, but greetings from two Patreons in Finland. On the weekend, our local archaeological group was excavating a Stone Age settlement near Helsinki. We also unearthed another Time Team fan who we're trying to recruit as a Patreon. And there is the photo. Brilliant stuff. Well, it's great to have you on board, and thank you for waving the flag and beating the drum for Patreon. It is very, very nice to see you. Let's get to the questions, which this week come in video form. And the first one comes from Charlene. Take it away, Charlene.
Hi, Helen. My question is, have you ever been excited to dig a particular excavation site and then been disappointed? If so, what site and why? Thanks.
Okay, Helen, over to you.
For Time Teams, Warburton is the one that often comes to mind. Now, Warburton was billed as a Roman fort, and most of this, I would say, was taken from the finds. But neither me nor the local FLO had actually seen the finds. We'd just been told about them, you know, so we got a list of what there was, but we hadn't actually seen them. We got there on day one and we were a little bit horrified. We took out those that were certainly not Roman out of this huge table of finds. So we put those down at one end, and then we took out the ones that we couldn't date at all. And when we were left with things that were certainly Roman, it was something like six brooches and a handful of coins. And we looked at each other and we thought, this is just background noise. And then Phil couldn't find any features. Phil and Matt were desperately looking for features, and they found a ditch that you couldn't really date. You could watch us struggling in real time to explain what was going on. And in the end, I filmed this scene. I mean, it's one of those ones that I haven't been back to look at for a long time, and I've never been quite sure whether it was used. I said, you know how you can go into a cathedral or even a parish church and you can be moved because people have been doing the same thing, having the same emotions, doing the same rituals for hundreds or even over 1,000 years. And I said, well, in this field, people have been doing the same thing for probably many, many thousands of years. It has been an agricultural field for many thousands of years, and we should find that that moves us in the same way as a cathedral does. And all of the crew fell about laughing. You know, the camera person and the sound person and the director and everybody has said, you can't, that's ridiculous. You're not really seriously saying that, are you? But since then, I have heard the same emotion expressed in poetry. As you walk across a field, you're travelling in the footsteps of thousands of people over thousands of years who've seen that landscape, who've been there, who've appreciated its beauty or sighed at its lack of maintenance or its tangled nature or whatever, or have listened to a bird or have noticed a hare. It should be something that we remember that just countryside is a place that's populated by people as well.
That is very poetic, actually. At the start, I was siding with the crew, and now I'm siding with you.
Thank
I thought
you.
That was very nice. Charlene, thank you very much for the question. Brilliant. Let's head over to our second and final question, and it's over to the US and Terry. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Helen and Martin and Time Team. Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you for answering my question, which is, I was wondering, how many times archaeology either proved or disproved existing history?
Now, Helen, before you answer Terry's question, is that beehives behind Terry, do you think?
Well, I think it might be. Certainly some of them look like beehives, but there are so many different styles. I am, in a very small way, an amateur beekeeper. Some of them look familiar to me, but Terry, if she is a beekeeper, she is definitely a very experienced and good one because she's standing quite close to them without any protective equipment. Either that or she's a beekeeping supplies supplier. So, Terry, get in touch and tell us what those enigmatic objects are behind you.
I think it is, but I think I could see some bees buzzing around Terry. Oh. I think she's just extremely brave. That's what I'll have to say. Anyway, a great question. Thoughts, Helen?
Yes, well, I think, again, it's the clash between history and archaeology. So documentary history is often about kind of what you might call events, and archaeology is usually about long-term everyday life. So there are a few events that you can think of that have been changed by archaeology. An example is that nearly everything around Richard III has been shown by archaeology to be wrong. So the Battle of Bosworth Field was thought to be in one place, and then archaeology showed that it was 2 miles south. And of course, archaeology famously discovered Richard's burial place in Leicester when most people thought that his body had been dug up and thrown into the river. So sometimes those primary historical accounts are shown to be wrong. But I think it's more often that just our kind of beliefs about life in the past are shown to be, well, often just prejudiced. So most people think that hardly anybody in the medieval world could read, and they think that women didn't work outside the home. But recording seal matrices, so what I do every day on the Portable Antiquities Scheme, the recording of those has shown us that in the 13th century at least, a lot of them belong to women. It could be that women are as likely to have seals and access to sealing, and so access to written documents, so a basic ability to be literate. Women could be as literate as men. It does seem likely to me that everybody had their own seal, and that everybody could in some way read. Maybe not very much, maybe only their own name. Everybody, men and women, were engaging in literate culture. So that would be my top example of how archaeology has shown history to be wrong.
That's really good. And also not where I thought you'd go with it, Very, very interesting and a brilliant, brilliant question, Terry. Thank you so much for getting in touch. Stay safe, please, with the bees. and we want to, because we want to hear from you again. We want more questions from you. Right, if you have a question and you want to get in touch, really easy to do. You just have to support us on Patreon. And if you do that, you don't just get the opportunity to ask us questions. You can also get so much more from Time Team. There are behind the scenes chats, there's extended interviews, everything that you could possibly want, including the opportunity to dig, to volunteer to dig at an archaeological site with Time Team. It is well worth doing. Just head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
That's about it for this week. And next week, we're going to be answering more of your questions, including a brilliant question about whether your DNA can be used to discover a long-lost relative buried in an ancient grave.
Yeah, it's a good one. So make sure you're following the Time Team podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss a single episode. And we'll catch you again on the next Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.